Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 14th day of May, 2022. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. I am delighted that Professor Alan Dershowitz is my guest again today on the show. He has been here before to very positive reviews. We sure have a number of issues to discuss, ranging from the Supreme Court of the United States, the leak, the protests outside of the justices' homes, Roe versus Wade, court packing, the politics of the Supreme Court, the politics of abortion, and on, if we have time, to the filibuster and freedom of speech and many others. I'm not looking today for a discussion about abortion itself. There are plenty of forms in which to do that, and I'm happy to do that on another show. But today, I want instead to discuss the constitutional aspects, the role of the Supreme Court, and the mechanics and the politics of the relationship between the three branches of our federal government as they're constituted in today's America, with the press and social media and all of the apparent division, which may not be as divided as it looks. And so it is my pleasure to say, Professor Alan Dershowitz, welcome back to TalkRadio1.com.
Well, thanks, except I think it's more divided than it looks. So we'll have a little disagreement about that. I think the divisions are even greater than would appear on the surface.
Well, you know what? Let's start there. I think there are about 10% of nuts on the left and about 10% of the nuts on the right, and about 80% of the people, it strikes me in daily conversation, which I have all the time about politics and government, that most people are center-left, center-right, but are not so sharply divided. How does it look to you?
Well, it depends. If I talk to people my age and your age, I think you're absolutely right. When I go to Harvard or Yale or any of the universities that are producing our future leaders, 15 years from now, the student editors of the Crimson, the Harvard Crimson, will be managing editors of the New York Times, members of Congress, justices of the Supreme Court, candidates for president of the United States. The divisions there are much greater. I would say that the nuts on the left probably are as much as 30%. The nuts on the right are far fewer, but they may be more extreme. The 10% in some ways is very extreme. And then there's another, 15 or 20% of people who think that Trump is the president of the United States to this day and won the election overwhelmingly. There are plenty of those also. But when you get to people our age, I'm almost 84, you're absolutely right. The nuts tend to be extreme, and then the most of the people are toward the center.
Professor Dershowitz, do you consider yourself to be center-left, center-right, or somewhere else personally in your politics?
A center-left. I don't like left, because left puts me on a continuum with people who I hate the most in the world, the AOCs, the Squad, Bernie and the extremists on the left. Now, I don't think it's a continuum. I don't think there's a continuum between liberal and radical. I think that liberals are closer to conservatives. Radicals are way off the chart, and they have nothing to do with me. So that's why I don't use the word left. I am a liberal libertarian who supports a woman's right to choose, who supports gay marriage, reasonable gun control, concern for the environment, separation of church and state. I am the true liberal. The people on the left are as liberal as they could possibly be. Larry Tribe is not a liberal. He is a radical person with a totalitarian mind. And I think many of my former colleagues on the left have kind of a totalitarian bent and a notion that the ends justify the means. And that's something that abhors me. And as a person who kind of grew up on the liberal side, I feel a special obligation to attack the left, just the way I think moderate conservatives have a special obligation to attack the extreme right.
One of the things, let's turn to the Supreme Court. Polling shows heavy public support for Roe versus Wade and a preference that Roe not be overturned. But when the conversation moves to counting weeks, political support tends to erode. What role should public opinion have in the rulings of the Supreme Court of the United States?
Virtually none, except in really extreme cases. We'll all remember the switch in time that saved nine, when the people of the country were overwhelmingly in favor of the New Deal. They had voted Franklin Roosevelt in overwhelmingly, and five justices were preventing the New Deal from being carried forward. And Roosevelt threatened to pack the court. And as a result of that fear, and it was a fear, obviously, of public reaction, the court shifted its views and began to uphold the New Deal. But I think in general, public opinion should not impact the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court was set up as a check and balance against public opinion. Let's take another example, separation of church and state. I don't think 20% of Americans believe in separation of church and state. I believe that 80% of Americans would love to have prayers in school. And of those, two-thirds would like the prayers to be to Jesus and to the Christian religion. They don't like separation of church and state. That's exactly why we have it in the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. So there, and the Kennedy case now before the Supreme Court is a perfect example. Here you have a coach, a popular coach, who engaged in Christian prayer in the middle of the field after the game. If you just imagine the same coach named Sharif Al something or other, and he gets up at the end of the game and he says to all those players, you know, this victory really belongs to Allah. And I want you to pray using the words of the Sharia to Allah and say, Allah al-Akbar. Can you imagine any school board allowing that? And yet that issue wasn't even raised by the Supreme Court justices. They will uphold this prayer, even though clearly the prayer would not be upheld if it was a non-Christian prayer. Probably even if it was a non-Protestant prayer, if it was a Catholic prayer, it probably wouldn't be upheld. And that's exactly what the Establishment Clause was intended to prevent. But prayer is popular. Prayer at football games is popular. And that will have an impact on the Supreme Court in that case. It will come out wrong, and it will lower the wall of separation between church and state, and the public will love it.
In God We Trust is on the money. One Nation Under God is in the Pledge of Allegiance. These things suggest that the Establishment Clause is there to protect religion from government, or is it there to protect government from religion, or both?
Both. Roger Williams talked about the garden in the wilderness, and the wilderness was the civic society, and the garden was the church, and it has done a good job. Church attendance is higher in the United States than anywhere in the democratic world, and we have separation of church and state. In England, where there's no separation of church and state, there's an official religion. You can't be the queen unless you're a Anglican. You can't be the prime minister. You have to convert all of that, and they don't go to church. The same thing in France. Nobody goes to church in France. So separation of church and state has been good for churches. It's been good for America, but it's not popular because people want to be able to pray in public and they want to be able to invoke Jesus in public. Look, in God We Trust is a compromise. Having ministers open Congress, even the Supreme Court, God save the Supreme Court from, not from this honorable court. We used to use that as a joke when I was a law clerk. God save the Supreme Court and this honorable court is a mistake. Jefferson would not have approved it, but look, what he's saying, God is different. But if it were to say Jesus saved the Supreme Court, that would, or Allah saved the Supreme Court, that would raise different issues.
So we had Senate hearings, and in those Senate hearings, Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch were asked questions about Roe versus Wade. And if you listen to the specific words they used in answering, they all said that Roe versus Wade is authority. It is settled authority. It is long authority. It is a case which deserves credit under the doctrine of stare decisis. What is stare decisis, and do you have any criticism of the answers that any of those nominees to the Supreme Court gave before the Senate hearing?
Yes, particularly Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, more so than Barrett. But let's remember one more thing that people forget about. The issue of Roe versus Wade is not, I'll say it three times, before the Supreme Court in the current case. The issue in the current case is only whether or not the Mississippi statute, which allows abortions up to 15 weeks, is constitutionally required. There's no reason for the Supreme Court to reach out in an activist way and overrule a case that's not before it. So when you combine that outreach, that overreach, that radicalism by the Supreme Court with what the three justices said during the confirmation hearings, you have a real ethical issue here.
So the press, when it is covered, talks about stare decisis. The thing is established. The decision is made. This is something where precedent should control. And that's the analysis that I hear. I hear practically no one talking about the concept of judicial restraint. What is judicial restraint?
Well, it was essentially invented by Justice Louis Brandeis, who almost didn't make it on the Supreme Court, because people like former President Taft didn't think there should be Jews on the Supreme Court, and the American Bar Association didn't think there should be Jews on the Supreme Court. Brandeis became one of the greatest justices in history, even though, by the way, the Constitution only mentions religion once, really. The body of the Constitution, no religious test shall ever be imposed for holding office, and yet these distinguished Bar Association types were prepared to impose a religious test. Many senators today, by the way, have said publicly they would impose a religious test on the Supreme Court, that they would never vote to confirm an atheist. So judicial restraint is what Brandeis said, and it was during the run-up, particularly to the New Deal. Don't reach decisions unless you have to. Judicial restraint says you should use the least constitutionally mandatory conclusion in a case. You don't reach out. You just decide the issues before you. And if you don't have to decide them, you shouldn't decide them. If you can decide a constitutional issue on statutory or administrative grounds, do it. But Brandeis would be rolling over in his grave to hear five justices of the Supreme Court say they will reach out to overrule Roe versus Wade, even though the issue is not properly before them in this case.
So in the case of Dobbs versus Jackson, which is the case pending now before the Supreme Court, which was the subject of the leaked opinion that is the subject of all this coverage, you would say that if the Supreme Court wanted to rule against the Mississippi statute, which severely limits the number of weeks that can go by before an abortion is prohibited, you would say that's what they should have done rather than even discuss Roe or Planned Parenthood versus Casey or any of the other cases and overturn them. You think the overreach is in doing more than the Supreme Court had to do. Is that your view?
That's not only my view, that's Chief Justice Roberts' view. And what he's been trying to do since February is to persuade at least one of the conservative justices, probably Kavanaugh, who was his benchmate on the D.C. Circuit, to engage in judicial restraint and just uphold the Mississippi statute and leave it for the next case. You know, there'll be a case if Oklahoma passes a statute or some other jurisdiction totally abolishing the right to abortion. If that happens, then that issue of Roe versus Wade would come before the court. But there's absolutely no reason for the Supreme Court to overrule Roe versus Wade in a case not raising that issue, not requiring that decision in order to reach the result that a majority wants to reach.
So right now we have five justices, which do not include Chief Justice John Roberts, who are prepared to vote, apparently, for this draft opinion that was leaked. And what you are saying is that if Justice Kavanaugh could be persuaded by Chief Justice Roberts to change his vote, then the result could be an opinion that ultimately might have six justices ruling for it, so it would be the five plus John Roberts, saying that the Mississippi statute is unconstitutional.
No, it's constitutional. It's constitutional.
Is constitutional, and leaving the question of Roe versus Wade for later. Explain that.
Okay, so the only issue in the Mississippi case is whether or not a statute that prohibits all abortions after 15 weeks is constitutional. I don't think it is. I don't think it should be held so, but we're not talking about my opinions now. We're talking about the court. There are six justices who think that that statute is constitutional, that that statute can be upheld under the Constitution. If they decide that that's constitutional, that's all they have to decide. They can have a little footnote saying we leave for another day if and when a legislature decides totally to overrule Roe versus Wade. We leave that decision for another day if and when it occurs. That's required by judicial restraint, by the case and controversy language of the Constitution itself. So I believe that overruling Roe versus Wade on this record would be unconstitutional.
So
in violation of the case and controversy restrictions on the Supreme Court's jurisdiction.
So this, I think, would result in exactly what you said, judicial restraint, which is, of course, the way it should be done. I also believe it would create more public confusion because while Roe versus Wade would then not have been overruled, Planned Parenthood versus Casey would not have been overruled, they would have been so eviscerated as to be of almost no effect, right?
Well, it's not almost no effect. 15 weeks is a lot of time, and a lot of women get abortions in the first 15 weeks. And so it would send obviously a message to state legislatures, be prepared. We may go the next step. And by the way, who knows who'll be on the court when the next step comes up? God basically determines who decides cases by deciding who will live and who will die. It brings me to another one of my pet peeves. Framers of the Constitution made a serious mistake by giving life tenure to justices or judges. Life tenure goes to popes and to kings. In a democracy, nobody should have life tenure. And the life tenure bit has encouraged presidents to appoint younger, and less experienced and less able, in my view, justices in order to get the most years out of their service. I think I would amend the Constitution to require retirement after 20 years, not an age limit, because if you have an age limit, presidents are going to start nominating fetuses to the Supreme Court to give them the longest amount of time. But if you have a 20-year term, then you're going to get people like Brandeis appointed at 60, Holmes appointed at 60, Ginsburg appointed at 60. Because if you're appointed at 60, you're going to get your 20 years under current longevity statistics. So it would be much better to have a 20-year term, and that way no one president could control the court for so many years as Trump's three appointments are going to control the court for many years. Remember, Jimmy Carter got no appointments as a one-term president. Clinton got two appointments as a two-term president. And Trump got three appointments, basically, as a one-term president.
One of those appointments was very controversial because when Justice Scalia died and the current Attorney General Merrick Garland was nominated by President Obama to take his place, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, it's too close to the election. We need to wait for the election. Now, of course, he took exactly the very same Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell took exactly the opposite position when a much shorter period of time remained in Donald Trump's presidency when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. And he said, no, we'll go forward and we'll have the hearing.
Total hypocrisy, but let's remember the hypocrisy didn't end with the Republicans. President Biden, when he was chairman of the Judiciary Committee, had earlier suggested that hearings should not be held for justices of the Supreme Court during an election year. He then changed his view on that. Look, nobody passes the shoe on the other foot test in politics. That's why you and I are not in politics, because we're honest people, consistent people, who won't simply allow our views to go with the wind. I think it was Groucho Marx who said, I have principles, and if you don't like them, I have other principles. that's what both Democrats and Republicans are showing when it comes to Supreme Court justices, and it's only going to get worse.
So let's talk about stare decisis just a moment more. When does it matter? When does it not? Or does it matter at all?
It matters a great deal. It's part of judicial restraint. No Supreme Court decision should be overruled except for a very good reason. You don't overrule a Supreme Court decision just because you have the votes to do so. this is radio, so I'm going to tell a slightly rude joke. You can censor it if you want to, but it's a slightly rude joke, but it makes the point better than any other. So the question is asked, why do dogs lick their testicles? And the answer is because they can. Why do Republicans stop the nomination of Garland? Because they can. Why are Democrats going to do the same thing over the years if they can? Because they can. And that because you can is not a moral principle. And that's what's going on. Everybody is just doing it because they can. I'm thinking of writing a book entitled Because They Can, starting out with that terrible joke.
From a constitutional point of view, Professor Alan Dershowitz, is it more accurate to say that abortion has been a constitutional right for 50 years and is now being lost, or is it more correct to say that abortion evidently never was a constitutional right?
Well, neither was the right for a black man to marry a white woman. Neither was the right of black children to go to college, to go to elementary school with white kids. If you went to the debates over the 14th Amendment and somebody during those debates said, oh, equal protection, does that mean that a black man can marry a white woman? They would have laughed him out of there. Are you crazy? There isn't a single person who would vote for that. The same thing would have been true of desegregated schools. So, of course, these rights are all construed, interpreted, changed. Roe versus Wade has a strong basis in the Constitution, not the one that the justices of the Supreme Court agreed to back in 1973. But I believe the Fourth Amendment says the right of the people to be secure in their persons. Now, it doesn't say privacy. Of course, it doesn't say privacy. There was no such word at the time of the Fourth Amendment. The word was security. If you asked anybody in 1793 or around there what protects your house from being invaded, they wouldn't say privacy. They never heard of the word privacy. They would say the security of the house. A man's home is his castle. An individual has the right to control his body. Now, of course, abortion is tough. It's much tougher than gay rights. Gay rights is easy. It's nobody's business who you marry, who you have sex with. Interracial marriage is easy. There's no third unit involved. With abortion, it's very different. Whether you believe that a fetus has life at conception or at the eighth month, there's something there. It's something. It's not a nothing. And therefore, the abortion issue is much more complicated as a matter of privacy. That's why I never use the term choice. I never use the term choice in terms of the body. A woman has the choice over her body. No, there's somebody else's body there. A woman has the right to abortion, not the right to choose. Nobody has the right to choose to kill a fetus. For example, if I see a pregnant woman walking down the street and I don't like her, and I kick her in the belly, that's murder, because she wanted to bear that child. How you extrapolate that to a woman who doesn't want to bear her child is a complicated moral issue. But I think we all have to agree, no matter how strongly you feel, as I do, that a woman should have the right to choose abortion, at least up to a certain point in her pregnancy. It's a compromise. It's a choice of evils. It's a hard moral decision. Gay rights, who cares? Nobody's business.
One of the things that is an issue here is the issue of privacy, and that Roe, based upon a couple of other cases, had said that that Roe versus Wade is based on a right of privacy found in the penumbra of a variety of other rights in the Constitution. And would it have been better if Roe versus Wade had based its decision on equal protection? Because the reason I ask is that in the Obergefell case, the one that said that gay marriage is constitutional, it was based on the right of privacy, similarly to Roe. And there's some question now in public discussion as to whether Obergefell could be subject to some threat from the same Supreme Court that might rule in Dobbs versus Jackson in the coming weeks. So would equal protection have been a better basis for both cases? And if so, why wasn't that the point in Roe versus Wade?
Well, it would have been a better protection in gay rights cases, because there a gay person has the equal right of anybody else to love and to marriage. It would not have been a good basis for Roe versus Wade, because there is a countervailing consideration. Look, you have to be direct and honest about Roe versus Wade. It's a stretch. It's a very difficult decision, particularly if it applies beyond the first trimester. It's a very difficult decision. It doesn't fit neatly into the right of privacy because somebody else is involved. It doesn't fit neatly into equal protection. It doesn't fit neatly into any aspect of the Constitution. For me,
the question is really one of judicial politics as much as it is one of constitutional law. There are arguments both ways as to whether or not Roe versus Wade should have been decided as a constitutional issue. From a political point of view, it probably helped the Republicans, because a lot of suburban, moderate Republican voters who didn't want their daughters to have back alley abortions probably began to vote Democrat. And if the issue had been made political, I think a lot of those voters would vote Democrat. Today, they can afford to vote Republican because, or they could have before Roe versus Wade, or after Roe versus Wade, but before the current decision, because the right of a woman to have an abortion was safeguarded by the Supreme Court. Now that it will be up to politics, the vast majority of Americans support a girl, a woman's right to have abortion, certainly under many circumstances, rape, incest, very young, health reasons. So I think the Democrats will benefit enormously. As a constitutional matter, there are reasonable arguments on both sides. My friend Akhil Amar at Yale, who's a strong supporter of a woman's right to have abortions, doesn't think Roe versus Wade passes constitutional muster. Professor Lawrence Tribe, who is extremely result-oriented in everything he analyzes, thinks it does, and that this decision will take us back to a Neanderthal time. No, it will take us back to being like most other countries in the world, namely having abortion in a legislative matter. But these are very close and difficult questions.
We have leaks in – we have this opinion that was leaked. Now, we regularly have leaks in the executive branch. We regularly have leaks in the legislative branch. We have had leaks from the Supreme Court, but nothing like this, where a whole 92-page opinion is leaked. This is a spectacular leak, and there are reasons to believe that it was leaked by a liberal. There are reasons to believe it was leaked by a conservative. Is this important? Does the leak matter? And if so, why?
It does matter. It does matter. It was a clear act of civil disobedience, an act of lawlessness. May not violate criminal law, but certainly violates expectations and oaths. An act of civil disobedience by a person who feels so strongly about abortion that she or he was willing to violate their oath and jeopardize their careers. The reason I think it was done by a pro-abortion law clerk is that the left is already lionizing the leaker as a hero, and the right is already condemning the leaker as a traitor, or using language akin to that. That doesn't necessarily prove who it was, but it certainly puts a heavy thumb on the scale in favor of it being somebody who leaked it in order to try to get some change, to try to see whether or not leaking the opinion will result in legislative change, hasn't so far, maybe in a change of vote in the Supreme Court. One doesn't know, but clearly, I think it was designed to achieve a result, and it was an act of, as I say, civil disobedience, and civil disobedience is not lawful, and that's why it's called disobedience.
You presented the argument for why it would be a liberal. Let me present two arguments for why it would be a conservative. A conservative might have noticed that Justice Kavanaugh might have been wavering, perhaps might have been persuaded by Chief Justice Roberts to change his vote, and wanted to publicize it so that Justice Kavanaugh would feel the wrath of people who wanted the Roe overturned, if he were then to publicly, if he were now to change his vote, everyone would know it was him. He would not have the plausible deniability of thinking, well, maybe it's someone else. So that would be one. Another argument for why it would be a conservative is to get the word out there in early May rather than in late June so that the firestorm would blow over in time, that the political impact on this November's elections would be minimized. What do you think of those two arguments?
Well, I think the second one makes some sense. I don't agree with the first one. It obviously would have been public if Kavanaugh changed the vote and the vote ended up being, you know, four justices for overruling Roe versus Wade, two for upholding the Mississippi statute, and three for maintaining the status quo. Whether this in fact might have an impact on Kavanaugh, I don't think so. I think Kavanaugh has an easy argument to make. Look, I signed on to that opinion back in February when we had our conference. That was my preliminary vote. I do that often. Then I saw opinions circulated by the Chief Justice and others, and we're a deliberative body, and I changed my mind, and I'm not going to let a leak influence my decision. So, no, I'm voting with Rob. By the way, I think that may still happen. I think there's a possibility that we may still have a 4-2-3 vote.
Leaving Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey intact, but sustaining the Mississippi law and thus leaving the question of Roe versus Wade for a future decision.
Yeah, it wouldn't keep Roe versus Wade and Casey intact. It would substantially cut back on both of them, but it would do so without the symbolism of overreaching and activism and going out of their way to overrule a case that's not before them. I think it would be much better for the Supreme Court. I bet you that's the argument that Roberts, who I remember from law school and I think very, very highly of, I think that's the argument that is being made now by Chief Justice Roberts to Kavanaugh and to perhaps Barrett. It's the integrity of the court. Don't decide cases that are not before it. You can have a concurring opinion saying, I personally believe Roe versus Wade was wrongly decided, and if and when an appropriate case comes before us, I will certainly take that into consideration. But the idea of voting to overrule a case when the issue is not before the court is something that I think Chief Justice Roberts feels very strongly about and may very well be able to persuade one of the conservative justices that he's right, because he is right.
And the argument would be that conservative judicial activism is no better than liberal judicial activism, and that a purist who is looking at the Supreme Court, and we should all be purists in looking at the Supreme Court, would say that neither side should ever fail to exercise judicial restraint.
No, I disagree with you on that. I think it's much, much, much worse if conservatives don't engage in judicial restraint.
Why?
Because there are some liberals who don't believe in it, who have said over and over again, the role of the Supreme Court is to protect minorities. It's to achieve. Earl Warren said that, and it was said even by Justice Jackson, his famous footnote in a case a long time ago. So the liberal perspective hasn't been as strongly against judicial activism, whereas conservatives are so against judicial activism. And for them to reach out and decide an issue not before them is much worse than for liberals to do it.
Similar to why there is a much greater political consequence when a conservative who is putting forth conservative values is found to be, for example, cheating on his wife. That's much worse than when a liberal does, because the liberal might say, well, that's a different standard anyway. Is that your view?
No, I don't think anybody should cheat on their wives. I don't think there's a liberal conservative bias in favor of liberals being less honest than conservatives. I think everybody should stick to their oaths and not violate them and stick to their principles.
But yeah. You're making a hypocrisy argument with judicial activism if a conservative does this. You're saying it's hypocritical to say
it is, but it's also hypocritical for a liberal. You know, liberals don't believe in lying. Liberals don't believe in stretching the truth. They don't believe in being dishonest to one's wife. So I don't like the analogy. Whereas liberals do believe in judicial activism. So I think your analogy works only on the conservative side, but not on the liberal side.
I actually agree with you completely. The protests that are taking place in front of the homes, the personal residences of the Supreme Court justices right now, Pod Save America said this week that the water-soluble chalk on the ground that caused Susan Collins to call the police is much less important than the potential loss of a constitutional right. These protests are an expression of public opinion. Public opinion and free speech is a critical and central power of our country, and without it, we don't have a country. And yet, here we have protests in front of the homes of Supreme Court justices. What do you think?
Well, my view is that I condemn the protests and I will defend them constitutionally. I believe that nobody should go in front of a justice's house and protest. They shouldn't get in their face when they're having dinner. They shouldn't protest it in front of their kids' schools. It's wrong. It's immoral. It's inconsistent with American values, but it's constitutionally protected. I believe the statute that prohibits picketing and protests in front of the homes of judges, jurors, and witnesses with an intent to influence justice is constitutional as it relates to jurors and witnesses, but not constitutional as it relates to justices and judges who have life tenure.
What's the distinction?
And I think the courts support that.
What's the distinction?
Justices are supposed to have thick skins, and they're not supposed to be subject to this kind of intimidation. Whereas jurors, you know, have to go back to their families. And we've seen the horrible effects of these kinds of things on jurors in the Kim Potter case. Go back to the Leo Frank case. Go back to many of the cases in the South where jurors were intimidated into giving improper and racist verdicts. But judges are supposed to be able to withstand that. So I would not uphold the constitutionality of an anti-picketing, anti-protest statute as it relates to the homes of justices. So I think it's appalling that they're doing it. I've defended many people whose actions I think are appalling.
We might finally actually disagree on this for this reason. The Supreme Court over the decades has uniformly held that the right to free speech, though truly powerful and truly critical, and it requires compelling interests to limit it, is limited. It's not absolute. You can't shout fire in a crowded theater. You can't call for violence. You can't slander and so forth. And one of the things the court has said repeatedly is that it is appropriate to regulate free speech as to time, place, and manner. Would it not be acceptable at some level to regulate the time, place, and manner of those protests to say, they can take place out in front of the Supreme Court and in a variety of other areas, but not in the place of the personal homes, because while a judge should have thick skin, should their spouses and children or visiting friends or parents have thick skins? Should they be required when a judge is a judge to endure that, or should there be some time, place, and manner restriction?
Well, I think I agree with the time, place, and manner restrictions, but I don't think they should apply to prevent demonstrations across the street from a home that end at 10 o'clock at night. You're married to a judge. Your parent is a judge. You have to begin to endure things. Once you mention shouting fire in the theater, that's the worst analogy ever made by a Supreme Court justice. I would say if it weren't Oliver Wendell Holmes, it would have been the dumbest analogy, but he was smart. He was just dishonest. Think about shouting fire in a theater. Shouting fire in a theater isn't a shout. It's exactly the same as setting off a fire alarm. Would anybody suggest that setting off a fire alarm, knowing in a crowded theater, knowing that there was no fire, of course that's not protected because it's not speech. Yelling fire is not speech. It is not designed to go to the brain. It's designed to go to the legs. I wrote an article about this a long time ago. It was picked as the best essay of the year when I wrote it, saying that shouting fire in the theater should never, ever be invoked. It's the worst analogy possible. Totally and thoroughly dishonest. What would have been an analogy is if somebody stood in front of a theater, gave out a brochure and said, by the way, you shouldn't go into that theater because it's a fire hazard. Of course, that would be protected speech. Even if there wasn't a fire hazard, that would be protected speech. But shouting fire is exactly the same as setting off an alarm. And the alarm, and nobody would say that an alarm is speech. And yelling the word fire is not speech. It's not covered by the First Amendment. So I reject that analogy. But you're absolutely right that there are limitations on time and manner. You can't burst into a church and start screaming at the minister. You can't interrupt proceedings. But generally, time, place, and manner restrictions have allowed protests in front of homes as long as they're not right at the home. Take, for example, the funeral case where the Supreme Court did uphold the right of this horrible, vicious organization to protest the burial
yes.
of a hero. And you would think that time, manner restrictions would say, no, a person is allowed to bury their loved ones in peace. But the First Amendment was not designed to make people comfortable or all of that. That's why basic decency is. And that's why I would not participate in a demonstration in front of a justice's home. But I would defend the right of the protesters to do it under the First Amendment. But we might disagree. That's what
We're back in agreement on that. That's good. So you mentioned earlier that when President Franklin Roosevelt was pushing through legislation for the New Deal, that there were threats of court packing from Roosevelt,
right.
And it changed the court. The court acceded to this. And though generally you said that the court judges always should be immune from outside
That's right.
pressure and public opinion because, you know, if a judge is looking at a criminal defendant and thinking, you know, this criminal defendant, I'm about to find him not guilty, but there's a big crowd outside who thinks he's guilty, so probably I better find him guilty. That would be a travesty.
Yeah.
There's talk today
yeah.
of packing the Supreme Court in response to the potential ruling in Dobbs versus Jackson. Court packing, good policy, bad policy, good politics, bad politics.
Both bad policy and bad politics. It's bad politics because if, you know, the Democrats put three new justices on the next time the Republicans get the power, they'll put six new on and we're going to get a Supreme Court the size of Congress. So it's just bad politics, bad policy, and it will destroy the Supreme Court. So I'm very much against a court packing. The only amendment that I would make, as I said, is I would restrict justices and judges to 20-year terms.
Now, why 20-year terms? If you were to do something that allowed, for example, each term of a president to appoint a Supreme Court justice every 4 years, every president would be able to do one, and then
that would be court packing. Then you'd get 10 justices, 11 justices, because if you got a president in the fourth year of his term, like Carter, who hadn't gotten to appoint somebody, he gets to appoint somebody, so there would be 10 justices. I don't like that.
Okay. There is a concern of a slippery slope argument that Dobbs versus Jackson could then result in challenges to, for example, IVF or contraception or gay marriage under Obergefell or even interracial marriage,
right.
that could be done, although it's hard to picture that Clarence Thomas would vote to make his own marriage illegal. What do you think of the overall slippery slope argument, and what do you read? I assume you and I are two of the of a very small minority of people who've actually read the entire 92-page leaked
yeah.
opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you take from the language of Samuel Alito in referring obliquely to Obergefell and other precedents?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I think I might disagree with you on Thomas. I can imagine Thomas saying, I am married to a white woman, and I am married to a white woman because the legislature has authorized it. I don't necessarily believe that my marriage is constitutionally protected. I think it's legislatively protected. I can imagine him saying that. He's the kind of person who might actually do that.
You know, I hadn't thought of that, but that is an argument that would be consistent with his opinions. That's interesting.
Yeah. Look, I think the court went out of its way to try to reassure the public that this case, deals only with abortion, but obviously, you're going to get fundamentalist Christians and other very conservative people trying to overrule the gay marriage and gay rights cases. They're not going to try to overrule the interracial cases, and they're not going to try to overrule the conception cases, Griswold versus Connecticut, because they would get nowhere with those either politically or constitutionally. But they might very well try to set back gay marriage and gay rights cases. I think more likely gay marriage cases than gay rights cases, but they will fail.
Let's switch in the remaining time to politics directly and the politics of abortion. A Navigator poll this past week said 60% of Americans support abortion in the first trimester, 28% in the second trimester, 80% say that the abortion decision should be left between a woman and her doctor, while 9% say it should be up to politicians and government. But there are questions about the political salience of this issue to most voters. There are some right. litmus test single-issue voters, but not that many. And Roe's ruling is popular now after 50 years, as a serious majority don't want it overturned. The Congress just now, led by Chuck Schumer as Senate Majority Leader, brought forth the Women's Health Protection Act, which protected abortion, not according to the Roe standard, but all the way to the date of birth, so that you could have an abortion after 9 months and it would be legal. Now, this failed 49-51, so all of the Democrats voted for it.
With one exception,
Joe Manchin, which is how it ended up 49-51. Does this hand a baseball bat to Republicans because 49 Democrats voted to protect abortion through the entire pregnancy? Will this be a political device?
I think it was designed to shore up the Democratic base. Everybody knew it was going to lose, and it was a fake vote. And if they wanted it to pass, they would have tried to get a compromise piece of legislation along with the two Republican women who generally support choose abortion, but they didn't want it. They wanted to have a vote to use for political purposes, and each party thinks they're going to benefit from this vote, and only time will tell. Look, the vast majority of Americans approve of a woman's right to choose an abortion, but it's not a core issue for many of them. Whereas the other side, even though it's only a small number of people, they vote that one issue. And so a lot of politicians listen to the right to lifers more than they listen to the right to choose abortion people, because they know they're more likely to get a vote based solely on that. So it's complicated politically, but we have to wait and see. And, you know, the midterm elections will be complicated by inflation, but so many other issues that it's not going to be we'll see what COVID goes to, and it's not going to be a single issue determination.
So you are saying, in essence, that message voting is what the Senate and Chuck Schumer were doing, and Chuck Schumer himself said, and I quote, "We are not looking to compromise on something as vital as this," and of course, by not compromising, he didn't get anything. Wouldn't it be a better idea to say what we're doing is we want to codify the Roe versus Wade standard, the three trimester test, and to get then to get maybe 52 votes, because you would then pick up Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski in addition to Joe Manchin, and it would go down to a 52-48 defeat, but it would show bipartisan support. And be able to get somewhere with it, and then you would have something the Democrats could use in November. Would that not be a better idea?
Of course it would, and it would have been better for America. to get compromise vote that maybe even could have gotten 60 people if it was the right thing. Because as you say, the vast majority of Americans support abortion during the first trimester. They certainly support abortion pills. They certainly wouldn't support making it a crime to go from Texas to California to get an abortion. So, you know, abortion, yes or no, is not the issue. It shouldn't be the issue. The issue should be, can you carve out legislation that protects most abortions that are proper, while giving the other side something that gives some of them a justification for voting for it? It's politics, and Schumer is playing a different kind of politics. He's playing an electoral politics game rather than a result game.
Let's talk about the filibuster and 60 votes in general. When Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said that he was, during the Obama administration, when President Obama was having trouble getting his judges appointed because he couldn't get 60 votes, Harry Reid said that we're going to change the standard for approving judges, the advice and consent of the Senate on approving judges for the lower courts, so it requires a simple majority while leaving 60 votes required to confirm a Supreme Court nominee. And at that time, Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader at that point, said, well, it won't be long before something shifts and you'll be sorry you did that. And of course, when it did shift and Mitch McConnell was the majority leader, he said, well, now it only takes 51 votes to confirm a Supreme Court nominee. And of course, that was Donald Trump's first appointment and his second appointment and his third appointment. What do you think of the idea of getting rid of the filibuster? Is that good for one side or another? Is that a good idea, or is that just a bad idea all the way around?
Well, they got it exactly backwards. The filibuster should be in place for all judicial nominations. You should require 60. If I were writing the Constitution, I would say 2/3, 67 for judicial appointments. If you want to appoint somebody for life to influence the country in a non-democratic way, that better be a consensus candidate. So if I were writing a constitution, I would require 67 votes for confirmation for any judge. That would force presidents to nominate moderates, centrists, people who could get the support of both parties. But I would not have a filibuster for ordinary legislation. I think a majority should rule on ordinary legislation. So it's exactly backwards. The Senate, as usual, just got it completely wrong because it was decided by the politics of the day or of the moment. And, you know, the Senate is supposed to be a thoughtful institution that looks beyond tomorrow's election. That's why we give them 6 years, not 2 years. And the Senate isn't doing its job. There should be no filibuster on ordinary legislation. And there should be a filibuster or a 60 vote requirement for all judicial nominees. You don't get to serve for life on a court as important as the Supreme Court on a 50-50 vote. That almost happens, never happened, and it'd be an interesting issue whether the vice president can actually vote to consent to a nomination to break a 50-50 tie, but we didn't reach that. But we've now had judicial nominations approved, 51 or 52. That's just not right. That's not the way it should work.
So you would say get rid of the filibuster, not for judicial nominations, but for everything else. And if the Republicans take the Senate this November, do you think they will get rid of the filibuster?
Yeah, I do. I don't think they're going to take the Senate, but I think they will get rid of the filibuster if they do, because, you know, politics are tomorrow, today, not the day after tomorrow. Very few people have looked to long-term interests of the United States when it comes to political actions that will help them get reelected or help the party get reelected in the next election.
On the subject of free speech, this past week, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas announced the formation of a disinformation governance board. A disinformation governance board.
Really, really stupid. Really just stupid, you know, tone deaf. No matter what the actual role is, to even think about giving the government the power to decide What's disinformation? Chief Justice Rehnquist got it right when he said the First Amendment knows no such thing as a false idea. Everything is subject to the marketplace of ideas. Government can't tell you something is false or true. In a limited context, they can. Medically, they can tell you we're not going to allow you to use this pharmaceutical drug because it hasn't been tested sufficiently. But the idea of saying what's true and what's false politically, oh my God, just read Larry Tribe and you'll see the dangers. What he thinks is true is just not true in so many instances, and so many people on the right and the left, if they're given the power of government to tell you what's true and what's not true. Truth is a process. The truthing process is what's protected by the First Amendment. And that process requires that all points of view be heard without the government putting its thumb, or in this case, its elbow and its rear end on the scale of the marketplace of ideas.
We're going to talk about you and I are going to talk again before the November election, and certainly before the 2024 election.
Sure.
Either on this show or on your show. We'll talk about your show.
Good.
In just a moment. But let me get some lightning round questions for you. Who will
Sure.
win the House in November?
I think the Democrats lose the House in November. And lose it pretty overwhelmingly. The Roe versus Wade decision may help them a little, but not enough.
You said that they keep the Senate, though. Why? What is the reason the Democrats keep the Senate in November?
Probably because there are more difficult seats up for grab that the Republicans can capture. But it's certainly possible that the Republicans will get the Senate as well, but not as likely as the House.
Will Donald Trump run for president in 24?
If he thinks he can win, he will. And if his health maintains, I think he will. Yeah.
Will he get the nomination if he runs?
If he wants the nomination, he has it. Will he win the election? That's a much, much harder question.
And
who he runs against.
And that will depend on who he runs against. And who do you think the, say, top three contenders are for Democrat for president in 24? And by top three, I mean who's most likely, the people who are most likely to A, get the nomination, and B, win the general?
Well, the two different questions. I think getting the nomination, most likely, will be Biden. If he wants it, he can have it. I think the harder question will be, if he doesn't want it, whether or not Harris could get it, or whether or not she'd be challenged by Hillary Clinton, by Klobuchar, by Liz Warren. Don't know. If Biden doesn't get it, I think it's up for grabs.
Which Democrat could beat Donald Trump in 24? Democrat
Klobuchar.
Or Democrats?
Klobuchar, I think. And I think Klobuchar could be. I think you need somebody who was an anti-Trump. That's how Biden won. He was the anti-Trump. Moderate, down the middle, not too many negatives. That's what you need to beat Trump, no negatives. That's why Hillary Clinton lost. She had too many negatives.
So then who would that leave besides Amy Klobuchar who could actually challenge successfully Donald Trump in a general in 24?
You know, there are, between now and then, a lot of names could emerge. It's not clear to me who else would emerge, but... I think she would be right now has the best name recognition and the least negative. She has some negatives, but I think she would present probably the strongest case.
Talk to me about the Dersh show. What is it? And what's your theory behind it? Why do you like it?
Well, I love it. It's, you know, the Dersh show. The only thing missing is the wits that's provided by my viewers and listeners. I put it on live 3 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 5:30 to 6. And it can be heard anytime, 24/7 on Rumble or any of the other platforms. And, you know, in it, I divide the show in two for 20 minutes. I express very controversial, strong views on the First Amendment, on politics, on law. And then for the last 10 minutes, I answer questions that are written to me by the viewers. I get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of questions, some really, really, really stupid and bigoted. And I even read some of those, and most fairly intelligent.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's available on Rumble, on Apple Podcasts, on Audible, or wherever you get your podcasts. The Dersh Show, D-E-R-S-H-O-W. And it's fascinating. It's a lot of fun. I would recommend it. Professor Alan Dershowitz, I want to say thank you so much for being with me today here on TalkRadio1.com. I hope to do it again very soon.
So do I. Thank you so much for doing a great job.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been Professor Alan Dershowitz. Always fun. I always learn things. It's a tremendous privilege, and I'd love to hear your comments on it. Send me an email. In the meantime, do watch The Dersh Show. Again, it's on Rumble, Apple Podcasts, Audible, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's a lot of fun. It's fascinating. And for those of us who are political junkies, it is particularly satisfying, very, very helpful. My next show will be 1 week from today. My guest will be Judge Julie Field and Heidi Webb. Divorce can be one of the hardest things anyone has to go through. Judge Field and Heidi Webb will discuss how they are restructuring the way divorce is handled. That's 1 week from today, Saturday, May 21, 2022, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Please use our eBay, Amazon, and PayPal links to support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com to keep these podcasts available to you at no cost. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. I'd love to hear your, read your comments on the conversation I just had with Professor Dershowitz. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spear. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.